All right, episode number four. We have Nigel Morris and Frank Rotman of QED. Sadly, you guys have recorded this episode before the big Capital One Discover news. Regardless, we dive into a lot of really cool topics from starting Capital One to starting QED, what they've seen. I mean, these guys have been all across the globe and all across fintech for 10, 20 years now. As in the last episode, John joked that they couldn't listen to this on their flip phone still. So they definitely qualify with more of like the Matt Harris and Steve McLaughlin and just have so many good insights for all of us to hear. So I'm really excited for you guys to listen. Let's dive in. I've known FS Vector from my early days in fintech when I was a reporter at Bloomberg, trying to keep up on everything that was happening in the regulatory world with financial technology, which, spoiler alert, there's a lot going on all the time. In previous episodes, we've talked about their advisory, compliance, and training offerings, but another service that FS Vector offers is around state licensing for lenders and money transmitters. Obtaining and holding your own license can be a competitive advantage and an unlock to expanding your product offerings, but it's not an easy path. If you're looking to become a licensed money transmitter, lender, or digital assets company, the FS Vector licensing team can help acquire and maintain those licenses for you. FS Vector's licensing team works in tandem with other services they have to offer, including product advisory, compliance, independent assessment, and public policy. So if you're thinking about any of these topics, give the FS Vector team a shout at fsvector.com or click the link in the show notes. Nigel Morris is the co-founder and managing partner of QED Investors, a fintech venture capital platform focused on disruptive, high-growth financial services companies. QED has made numerous unicorn investments, including Credit Karma, Nubank, Avant, SoFi, Klarna, GreenSky, and AvidXchange. Nigel is the chairman of ClearScore and Mission Lane and serves on the boards of Remitly, Quinto Andar, Bitso, Amount, and Current. Additionally, he serves on the board of Ideas 42 and Scotia's Digital Advisory Council, and he works in an advisory capacity with General Atlantic and Oliver Wyman. Nigel previously worked on the boards of Capital One, The Economist, Brookings, National Geographic, Klarna, Braintree, TransUnion, and London Business School. Prior to QED, Nigel co-founded Capital One Financial Services in 1994. Under Nigel's leadership as President and Chief Operating Officer, Capital One pioneered an information-based strategy that transformed the consumer lending industry. Frank Rotman is a founding partner and Chief Investment Officer of QED Investors, a premier VC firm focused on the fintech ecosystem. QED has invested in 200-plus companies over the past 15 years and currently has $4.3 billion under management. Frank has made Forbes Midas list each of the past 6 years as one of the world's best VC investors. Before QED, Frank was one of the early architects who helped create what became Capital One. In his 13-year Capital One journey, Frank was responsible for many firsts that helped lay the foundation for what Capital One is today. He graduated from the University of Virginia with degrees in applied mathematics and systems engineering.
How are you, Frank? Are you cheerful and optimistic and enthusiastic today?
That would not define me any day, so today is not the exception.
I've got a substantial echo.
Now it's Frank just needs to mute himself. You're okay. Now you don't hear an echo, right, Nigel? Yeah, we're
Frank, are you
good.
you're being disruptive, Frank?
Frank's
Thank you.
just trying to make our lives complicated over here.
Oh, story of my life.
Well, so this series that we're doing has a bunch of fintech OGs, as we like to call it, in there. And obviously, if we're doing a fintech OG series, we have to have you guys in here. For those that aren't super familiar with Frank and Nigel, they come from the Capital One background. They helped start Capital One, and now they run QED, which is invested in a lot of fintech names that you have probably heard of, Credit Karma, Nubank. I could name a slew of other ones that they have invested in as well. So I'm really excited to have them on. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk to you guys in like a year probably, so we were overdue. Frank, I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about how you and Nigel met and, you know, what's made you stick around in fintech other than Nigel and his amazing accent? You know, you just want to stick around that. But what's made you stay in the space?
Yeah, so Nigel and I have worked together for 30 years, so that does date us a little bit. And Nigel recruited me right out of college, you know, into Signet Bank, which was the precursor of what became Capital One. So coming out of college, you know, you just interview with a bunch of companies, and I resonated and just felt like the people at Signet Bank were the type of people that I wanted to work with. I actually didn't have a background in banking or anything finance-oriented, so it was all going to be new for me. So I was relying on just the relationships that I had built through the interview process, and Nigel was one of the central figures in that, and he recruited me out of college.
Nigel, any regrets recruiting him?
Absolutely regret it. It was. For 30 years I've been trying to get escape velocity, but wherever I turn, there's Frank Rotman. No, look, I mean, you know, Frank and I have a pretty storied past, and you know, I'm much in his debt in oh so many ways. But you know, if we go right back to the onset, you know, Rich Fairbank and I were strategy consultants. We looked at the credit card business as consultants, working with the BCG spinoff out of Washington. And we said, look, this credit card business is a fantastic business. And we are not leveling the kind of analytical firepower that you can against this business. Everybody got the same price. We were not using any kind of discrimination in terms of segmentation, etc. So this is the so-called information-based strategy that was at the hallmark of Capital One's ascendancy, and I think is so much critical to Capital One's, you know, market cap of $40 billion today. And a critical part of that, and it came out of our consulting background, Julie, was, look, we wanted to hire really, really world-class problem solvers. You know, I to this day, I carry around a paradigm that says I want to go long on ambition and energy and verve and intellectual firepower and curiosity and short on experience and tree rings and what people know. Because we found it at Signet Bank. I mean, there were a lot of wonderful people there, but... And they taught us the credit card business in the very early days. But 6 months in, we were teaching them because we were pushing the envelope. And, you know, Frank quintessentially fitted that mold where you had somebody who, you know, had never done anything, never learned, never studied business, came out of a maths and computer science background, an AI background, but was a marvelous first principles problem solver. And that's what we wanted. That's what we needed. And so it was a real coup to bring Frank into that organization, you know, when he was in his early 20s and I was probably in my middle or late 20s at the time. We were just children and we grew up together, and we've been through many cauldrons and many fires and many exciting opportunities over these last 30 years.
Amazing. I love that. What, you know, on your journey, what have been, other than the decision to hire Frank Rotman, what have been some of the key decisions that you've made in terms of, you know, getting to the level of success that you have today, both in terms of Capital One as well as QED?
Go on, Frank. Have a go.
Look, I think Nigel tells this best, where we joke that if someone ever writes a book about not just Capital One, but about QED, we'll make it seem like there was a grand master strategy that we just executed flawlessly and we knew what we were doing from day one. And that's just not how we're operating. We're really figuring this out day by day. And I think the key is, you know, being true to ourselves and saying we want to be working on things that are interesting, but also where we can be helpful. And, you know, that's been a guiding principle for us in building QED. Like when we started QED, what we knew is that, you know, we had built a number of businesses that today would be called fintech businesses, and we knew how to manage, especially credit-oriented and banking-oriented businesses, but we had no idea if we would be helpful to the startup community. And we said to ourselves, look, if we're not helpful to the startup community and we don't really serve a purpose, we'll go do something else. But what we found is that the more that we inserted ourselves, the more people we talked to, the more companies we helped, like there actually was something there where the skills that we had could actually kink the curve on the outcomes for the founders. And that really was the foundation for QED. And every time we've expanded, it's because there are opportunities that we see in the market where we have a unique set of skills where we can be helpful. And we've been able to assemble a team that kind of lives by that brand where we're basically the best advice that a founder can get, bar none. And we're just trying to insert ourselves in places where we can be helpful. And then good things happen from there. But it's not like there's a grandmaster strategy that we're executing. It's just finding places where we can be helpful. And then, you know, ultimately good things happen as a result.
Yeah, look, in the Julian, the Capital One days, you know, we went from a very small group of people doing analytics and pricing and strategy and product market fit to cracking the code on balance transfer and on secured card and risk-based pricing and partnerships, and then scaling an infrastructure over, I don't know, from, you know, the very early days to the time going public, and then 10 years after that, me leaving, you know, from going from 1,000 people to over 20,000 people, a market cap of under $1 billion to over $20 billion, to being in the US to Canada, UK, France, Italy, Spain, South Africa, going from cards to installment loans, deposits, to CDs, to wealth management, to the full panoply of different products. We built that out over that period of time, and it was a spectacular learning experience. Not everything worked. And, you know, we learned a tremendous amount scaling that. And that experience base, I think, is incredibly rarefied in the world in which we operate. There are some really talented ex-operators who do venture, but very few of them have been on the journey that we've been on and have gone from tiny and nascent and incohate and a bunch of people running around full of energy and passion to something that's of massive industrial scale. And I think that experience has been totally invaluable. And for me and for Frank, going, you know, playing narrow analytical strategy roles in the very early days to learning about how to manage operations and compliance and regulators and fraud and credit risk and asset liability management and all these different things are really hard in fintech. I often say, look, the odd, you know, when we sit opposite a really excited young founder and she's saying, look, I can do this. I say, look, the odds are against you. I mean, and we can't make you successful, but we can increase the odds of you being successful. 1 in 20 of you will be successful. We can make those odds 1 in 6, 1 in 7, 1 in 4. Who knows what they can be? Because we know things that you don't even know that exist. They're unknowns to you, but known to us because we've been there. We've navigated them. Sometimes we've made mistakes around them. And now, you know, at a scale where we've made nearly, you know, 200 investments, 130 active companies, you know, 28 unicorns, over 4 billion in management, we're now industrial scale. And we have all that pattern recognition, which I think is really super. So, you know, I think that that's what we bring uniquely to the table. And specifically to the question of where do we go, I think we've worked really hard these last 15 years that Frank and I have been doing this together. And when we started off, it was a small family office, us exploring to get to the point where we have threshold scale now. We can start things, ClearScore, Mission Lane, Caribou, companies that we've started that have got to some significance. We can go all the way to IPO. We had 5 companies go public in 21. So we can go to all of the geographies in the world that really are of significance now. And we can do all the pieces of fintech. So I think that now we have this team of about 20 investment professionals, and just having done a big raise, I think we're in a perfect position to really prosecute that and leverage what we've spent all these years focused on building.
You make it sound so easy. Has it really been 15 years, by the way? I feel old.
Actually, February will be 16 years.
Oh my God.
Is that right, Frank?
Yep.
We'll have a party to celebrate.
Sweet 16.
Yeah, and we should say, Julie, when we started, the fintech label didn't even exist. We were taking the experience base of Capital One and the heuristics and paradigms that we'd learned, and applying them to, you know, startup entities. And we, as Frank mentioned earlier, we weren't sure if one we would be any good at it, I mean, I think we'd learned how to be operators, and that was something. But were we good investors or not? And were the skills that we would bring to the table unique? The last thing the world needs is another venture capital firm, right? And, you know, so would we be any good at it? Would we like it? Would our customers, both LPs and portfolio companies, say, look, what you're bringing to the table is different, and we will fund it, and we will support it, and we will let you invest in us and take you on the journey, and have you come on the journey with us. We weren't sure about those things. And, you know, 15 years ago, you know, I'll speak for myself, I didn't know an LP from a GP. I didn't know, you know, we were not schooled in how investing worked. But we could, I think, could recognize real talent and verve and ambition, and we could recognize opportunity because we had been inside, probably in Capital One, probably the first major fintech of scale. Now, people, you know, it depends when you start running the clock, doesn't it? Some people start with PayPal. But I think in our view, you know, Capital One, under, you know, with Rich Fairbank and myself and many others who we can't mention today, these were the pioneers. These were the breakthrough thinkers. And they laid out a paradigm and an approach that I think has been built on many, many times over since those very early heady days.
I want to touch back on something that you mentioned. You said 1 in 20 of you will be successful, and we can make that maybe like 1 in 6, 1 in 4. Where is that data coming from?
I just made it up, but directionally, okay. It's, yeah, directionally correct. Frank will give us the specifics now, won't you, Frank?
Sure. No, if you actually look at 10, 20, 30 years worth of venture data, vintages are different, but somewhere around 1% to 2% of companies end up IPOing, you know, that started as a seed stage professionally funded company at some point. You know, so if you actually think about the real odds of a big outcome, it's generally pretty low. Now, you have a lot of outcomes that are in the middle. There's a lot of M&A. Not every company has to IPO to be successful. But, you know, if your goal is to help find, build the biggest, most seminal, durable companies in the fintech space, the odds are really low. You know, so the fact that we have approaching 30 unicorns out of 200 and some odd companies that we've invested in, we have pretty good odds of helping companies that we've identified as both having the talent and the opportunity, turning them into something that's real.
Hi, fintech friends. Okay, mark your calendars for the event happening during New York Fintech Week, the 2024 Empire Fintech Conference. Picture this, a day jam-packed with masterclasses, live demos, inspiring keynotes, riveting live podcasts, and unparalleled networking opportunities. Join over 700 attendees, myself included, on Wednesday, April 10th, and immerse yourself at the forefront of fintech innovation. As a special treat to our listeners, aka you, you can use code FINTECHOG for 15% off at checkout. Just go to empirestartups.com to grab your ticket today.
Frank's absolutely right. Look, and every entrepreneur that sits opposite you at a table and pitches their thought and idea, they all believe they're going to be successful. They have to believe it, because if they didn't believe it, why would they put their body through the slings and arrows and the uncertainty that they're about to go through? They all believe that they can build, you know, they can be Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Bezos. And I think that's fantastic. And I think that what we find in the courtship process that exists in the top of the funnel management is that we're looking for the people that go, oh, wow, this is harder than I might have thought. And, you know, wow, I still believe I'm going to be successful, but I might want some really specialized, experienced, adaptable help alongside me that can bend the curve. And that's what we're looking for. You know, some entrepreneurs don't want that. They know how to do it, and they're going to be successful. Good luck. But, you know, I've got scars all over my body. Frank does too, of the mistakes that we've made and the mistakes that we've seen happen.
I want to touch on that a second too. You know, Capital One, obviously immensely successful and has done a lot to shape fintech where it is today. The number of times I work for some lending as a service companies, and the ways that what Capital One did has set them up to do further innovation in the lending space is just like bar none. But It wasn't a straight line to success. So talk to me a little bit about some of those lows while building Capital One, as well as building QED, where maybe you thought you weren't going to make it or things weren't looking good. And you really had to dig deep to get up that hill and turn things around.
Ooh. And there's a lot in that question. And you know, you sort of, when you look back nostalgically and retrospectively, Julia, you're quite right. It feels like there was an idea, there was an opportunity, and you lit the blue touch paper of the firework, and the firework went off, and everything worked. But you're quite right. There were lots and lots of ups and downs. And you know, in the very early days, Rich Fairbank and I both lived in Northern Virginia. He lived in McLean, I lived in Alexandria, and we would drive 4 or 5 times a week down to Richmond, 106 miles, 1 hour and 46 minutes. Stopping at the bagel store in Fredericksburg. And he and I would drive together. We had this dreadful old black Crown Victoria, and we'd drive it together every day. And we would, at the end of the day, we'd get in the car and I'd go, you know, Rich, I'm just not sure if this is going to work. This is too hard. You know, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to pull this off. And he would say, look, Nigel, let's keep the band together here. Let's stay focused on what we can pull off. And then that would reverse the next day. So what would I point to? I think one, having somebody to come on the journey with you is really important. And that was Rich and I in the Capital One days. And it's been Frank and I in the QED days. And I think that, and as you look at partnerships with founders, looking for two people who really complement each other, one more optimistic, one more careful, one more strategic, one more technical, whatever those complementary kind of bundles are. But that, I think that was really important. It helped us get through it. The second thing was a belief that let's start with facts and not opinion, and let's go to facts first as we problem solve together. And as companies get bigger, they get more powerful, people put you on pedestals, you know, it's all too easy to start to, you know, shoot from the hip too much. But both Rich and I, and then in the QED days, have this belief, you know, that let's start with the analytics, let's start with the strategy, let's start with the facts. What do we really know? So some of the, just a couple of times when there were lows and highs, and I'll let Frank talk about them a little bit too. And there was a board member called Ron Dietz at Capital One. And I remember Ron once said, it's never as good as you think it is at the best of times, and it's never as bad as you think it is at the worst of times. So we sometimes get caught up in the euphoria and in the nadir. But, you know, when we cracked the code on balance transfer, when we found that we could attack people who had low risk and had big balances, and we could offer them a teaser rate, a balance transfer product, and they would come to us in droves. Frank will remember what year that was, 1990, maybe 89,
90? No, it was a little later than that. It was scaling in 92 and 93. Yeah. And actually, when I showed up in 93, the whole balance transfer machinery was trying to be automated. So things were still being done by hand, writing checks, sending them in, doing three-way calls with customers in order to get the balance transfers through. And we were having so much volume coming in that it was actually blowing up. We were almost out of compliance because we weren't able to get things out the door quickly enough. And then, this will sound familiar to startups. I mean, we were a startup. And I remember, again, that same year, 1993, going into the holiday season, we were worried that there was so much volume coming in that the systems couldn't process transactions in real time, and the cards might go dead if we couldn't figure this out, approaching the holiday season. So every day we would come in, and every single day there would be a war room saying, have we figured out yet how to increase our transaction, you know, capacity?
It was a batch process overnight. We can't clear it fast enough. We're going to have a real meltdown, and that's going to lead to all kinds of knock-on problems and effects. Yeah. So look, we were in our naivete. I remember putting things in the mail, Frank, and not knowing operationally how we were going to support them. So we were testing and learning. We were on this journey. It was really exciting. We were all cool, and our appreciation and, I don't know, sensitivity to things technical and things operational was emerging, and we were just like, okay, we got a learning agenda. We're going on that learning agenda, and operations and tech and compliance, it'll keep up. Well, we had to learn we learned that the hard way, and a lot of leadership there. I think the other breakthroughs, I think when we cracked the code in the UK, And we built, you know, I think what is now the fourth largest credit card company in the UK out of Nottingham. And seeing the business model work in a different geography was a real threshold. That was really exciting. And then I guess the other one, Frank, was, you know, being able to open up the underserved populations, the near prime, the high street customer, the main street customer, the secure card customer. You know, Capital One today, more than any other credit card issuer on the planet, I think has developed the capability to be able to compete at the high volume convenience user, the very upscale customer, and at the same time to be able to deal with a customer that has a very different credit profile. And that speaks to the underlying dexterity of the business model. You know, if we look at Chase or Amex or Citi, they've focused very much at one end of the spectrum. And if we look at, you know, some of the near prime, subprime players, they're not going to compete anytime soon with the upmarket. So that flexibility has enabled Capital One to be able to dart and weave and be able to look for the opportunities and play across the spectrum.
Frank, Nigel has taken us on a Capital One look back down memory lane. Why don't you take us on a look back down QED memory lane?
Yeah, so the early days of QED, you know, we have to start back at 2008. So there were a few things that were going on in 2008 in the financial world, the main one being the global financial crisis. So talk about a bad time to start a fintech-focused fund. It probably was, when we started, it might have been the worst time possible. But the good news about that was there wasn't a lot going on. So by there not being a lot going on, it meant that we could actually touch everything that was interesting that was happening in the U.S., and we were starting to look, you know, at some of the other geographies that we knew well, like the U.K. But, you know, in 2008... you know, we just kind of raised our hands and said, we're here. No one was really there to listen, but we were raising our hands saying, we're here. And what we did is we said, look, this thing called fintech didn't have a name at the time. We thought of it as innovation in financial services and banking. It's something that's a very unique skill set. You know, it's something that not all of the venture capitalists are going to understand, and there isn't going to be necessarily a lot of deal flow. So what we did is we partnered with a bunch of other VC firms and private equity firms and said, look, let us be a second set of eyes for you. You know, if something comes across your desk in banking or in financial services, give us a call. You know, we'd be happy to actually look at it. We'd go into diligence with you. We'd help you evaluate the company. And, you know, if there's room and you decide to invest, let us invest alongside you. So we started by going to school through partnerships. And the partnerships were firms like General Atlantic and like Excel and NEA. I mean, there were a lot of interesting top-tier VC firms that we really were just a second set of eyes when they saw something in financial services. And what we learned over the first few years is that we actually did have a skill to evaluate these companies, and the founders, by and large, wanted to spend more time with us than with the generalists that had found them. So building up the discipline to be able to source deals, get out there so people knew who QED was, that was really something that we had to work at because we were an unknown player in the space. At the same time, fintech started to become bigger. You know, it actually got a name. We now know it as fintech. And the first incarnation of fintech really was in lending, which was in our sweet spot. So it was really about new UX, UI, and APIs and, you know, mobile and a bunch of other capabilities that made building new lending businesses possible. You know, a more frictionless experience for consumers. And it was right up our alley. And I even remember it was either 2012, I think, at the peak of this first generation of lenders coming about, we were seeing upwards of 300 new businesses a year just in lending. So we were able to see a lot of what was happening in the ecosystem. And little by little, you know, Nigel and myself and a few other people that we surrounded ourselves with got comfortable that we could be lead investors. We understood, you know, this thing called investing, not just in helping companies become better companies. And we became comfortable with the ability to not just tuck ourselves in with other VC firms, but really step out and be a lead. And at that point, we had already established a bit of a track record, and some of our early successes were starting to scale. We were investors in Credit Karma. We were investors in Klarna. We are investors in SoFi, in Avant, in Prosper. You know, there were a lot of really interesting companies that we were invested at the time. And we had started to expand into payments, and we were investors in Braintree and Flywire and Remitly. So a lot of the early companies that we invested in started to scale, which gave us the confidence in the market, the confidence that we deserved to exist in the market, and that we had something that was pretty unique. And every year it's just been scaling from there, taking on the challenge of expanding our surface area, not just in terms of products within banking and financial services, but also within geography. So, you know, we started by being mostly U.S. focused. We did a little bit in the U.K. We eventually expanded into Latin America with our first investment being Nubank. Not a bad first investment for a region. But we got comfortable with, you know, Mexico and Brazil and some other areas within in Latin America. And slowly we started to expand from there. We added Southeast Asia with a primary focus on India. And what was it, about a year and a half ago, we added Africa. And we have a few investments in Africa. So now we're covering most of the major geographies. As Nigel said, we can do anything in banking and financial services.
Look, in the fairly early days, Julie, back to what I mentioned earlier, we didn't know if we're any good at it, and we didn't know if we would like it. So going to school was really important through relationships, General Atlantic, as Frank mentioned, and Accel. And they were teaching us investing. And we brought specialist skills in lending and in payments and in regulatory and compliance. So could we'd grown up with those things. And that synergy, that symbiosis worked really well. And it gave us confidence that we could do this. As an organization, as QED, we don't big bang our way into things. We learn, we test, we probe, we figure things out. And we're patient and meticulous about that. So that was the first. A lot of compatriots of ours that start venture firms, they start with, I've got a big pile of money that people will give me. What shall I do with it? We started with, do we have a reason to exist, a raison d'etre? And so that learning process and, in a sense, testing into different spaces with smaller checks, learning about what things happen. And of course, the gestation period in venture is very long. It doesn't take, it takes many years to get an answer to the investment that you made today. The other thing that helped us terrifically was the Capital One diaspora, both in terms of hiring who we brought in, Bill Salufo and Yusuf Ostalda and Lauren Morton and many, many, and Mike Packer, many others who were top decile people at Capital One that as Capital One slowed and some people were looking for a different experience, they came knocking on our door and still do. We're based in Northern Virginia and in Richmond. So being able to tap into that diaspora to build the early scaffolding of QED was really important. And as you mentioned earlier, these people are now spread all over the planet in key roles and know us and reach out to us. And when they want to do something different or something innovative, we're often front and center. Getting positive selection in this business is really crucial. And, nobody rides their bike to come and present to us in Alexandria, Virginia, unlike people on Sand Hill Road. So we have to be out there. We have to build that brand so that we can, be first on people's list when they have a great idea. And we've worked really hard at that. The only final thing I would say, as you look from the bridge from the Capital One to QED, was Capital One was in its sense a precursor to digital. It was starting to do digital when we left, but it had become masters of direct mail and other distribution channels of origination. And it was the basic frameworks that existed at Capital One of net present value, of CAC to LTV, had been massively ingrained for decades or more at the time that we were beginning to put together QED. So we already had the frameworks that, people seem to have tripped across over the last few years. They were so much about the way we think, unit economics being a good example of it. So the bridge from the processes at Capital One to the two helping smaller companies was actually, we found to be easier than we thought and very, very relevant.
I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you both, I'll start with Frank. What is something you thought would have been accomplished by today that hasn't happened yet in the fintech space?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. I'll answer a slightly different question and then get to your question. But when we first started, our view of what the opportunity set was about snapping out a single product or service that a bank did and having a focus team with a basically blank sheet of paper do it better, right? With better technology, better teams, better processes, because the banks, by and large, had processes with lots of friction and archaic systems in place. And, you know, a new founding team should be able to snap out a single product or service and just do it better than the bank. And, you know, when we thought about that, we said, okay, we're going to be helping these teams build, you know, products that eventually are going to compete with the banks or the banks are going to want. And the majority of the outcomes, you're going to build this product and then a bank is going to want it and a bank is going to buy it. So we thought it was about, you know, in some ways unbundling products from the bank and then rebundling them, you know, when it was at scale by selling it back to the banks, you know, that you were competing against. And I think the art of the possible was discovered over the past, you know, 15 or 16 years, where much larger outcomes were possible than we ever thought. So the idea of a new bank being created was an interesting concept, but seeing a $40 billion public print like happen in a business that now is serving one in two customers in Brazil and competing with, you know, the Main Street banks in Brazil, like, it's just an amazing thing to see. And you've seen companies like PayPal emerge and Square, you know, and look at Stripe as another example. Like, there are some gigantic companies that have been built. So now that the art of the possible has been found and seen, you can't unsee it. And I think there's a lot of ambition in the fintech space now that you've discovered that you can build real, very, very large businesses. So when you ask, like, what hasn't been solved that I thought would have been solved, you know, you can really just look at every single product and service in the bank and say, is there a fintech competitor that's hit scale that's competing directly with the banks or helping the banks be better? And in some of the categories, the answer is yes. Like in payments, there's been a lot of innovation in payments. But if you look at some of the core products that banks offer, things like mortgage still hasn't been solved. It's one of the worst processes. It's almost like a 6 to 8 week proctology exam that at the end you're just happy that you ended up signing the paperwork and now you have a house. Like it's absolutely crazy, like, how much work there is in order to get a mortgage. And the same is true for a lot of other categories within banking. You scratch your head and you say, why hasn't this been solved yet? And there still are a lot of problems to solve. And if you look at the footprint that we have, you know, it's not just the US, it's international. And if you look internationally, there are a ton of problems that haven't been solved yet. In fact, we use the language, are we in chapter 2 or chapter 8 of fintech? It's a very important question to ask about, are you at the early stages of innovation happening or the late stages of innovation happening? And in some countries, we might not even be in chapter 1, right? So there's a lot of problems to solve. It really depends on your aperture and which geographies you're looking at, but there are a lot of problems that haven't been solved yet.
For the sake of argument, there were two schools of thought 5 years ago. One school of thought said, look, fintech is going to take over the banks. They have the technology and the talent. They're fueled by adventurous venture capital and PE firms. And the banks are going to really, really struggle to be able to compete. That's when we saw, you know, Klarna and Credit Karma, Affirm, Plaid begin to, you know, really get in escape velocity. There's another school of thought. And we spend a lot of time with the C-suite of the banks. He said, look, this is all twaddle. There's a bunch of children running around who don't really understand the complexity of the business. And I give you loads of examples of companies that forgot about asset liability management, Silicon Valley Bank, or people that forgot about fraud management, or people that forgot about unit economics, got lots of customers, but they never made any money. Both of those schools of thought are fundamentally wrong in our judgment. You know, I always said that in the end, some of the fintechs will get escape velocity and go public. Some will be bought by progressive banks. And most of them, Frank uses the term that Darwin is back, natural selection is back in the fintech space. Most of them will fail. And that's just how it is. And there'll be a new cohort, a new breakout, a new opportunity set that will emerge each coming year for the longest time. Why? Because fundamentally, financial services are broken. They are Massive friction, lack of transparency, terrible financial education. The financial service business worldwide, we did a study with BCG last year. Financial services, this is banking and insurance, is $12.5 trillion in revenue. And that profitability is $2.3 trillion. $2.3 trillion is bigger than the GDP of Italy. It would be basically the eighth largest economy in the world. And fintech added up, after all this talk, 15 years, Ascension, so many breakouts, is $245 billion in revenue. So it's precisely 2% penetrated into banking and insurance worldwide. And you say, wow, so we're only 2%. I thought it was bigger, but it's 2%. And the other thing is, if you look at the banks, you look at their net promoter scores, they're in single digit. You look at the net promoter score of Nubank, they publish it. It's in the 80s and 90s. Look at SoFi, look at these companies. They're so fanatically focused on customer and making the empowering the customer. So what allows me to be able to sleep at night, taking money from our wonderful LPs and looking to deploy it, is just there's so much opportunity because financial service is so big and candidly so broken. And it's part of the experience. Go flashback again. We went through this pain and suffering of converting Signet Bank, a wonderful, sleepy, but you know, highly authentic bank in Richmond, into Capital One, this direct mail analytical juggernaut. And it almost broke us. Now, to take B of A or Wells or a very traditional company and turn that into a new bank, it will take years and is borderline impossible. So I think there's just so much opportunity out there. So much opportunity.
Quick fire round. If you could have dinner with anyone dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Who would I like to have dinner with, dead or alive? Karl Marx, because I think he was a massive revolutionary and much maligned.
All right, Frank.
Quentin Tarantino, because I think he's a great storyteller and he's probably a lot of fun around dinner.
I bet Karl Marx is not much fun around dinner, by the way.
What has been a personal, so not QED or anything work-related, highlight from the past year?
Highlight? My wife has gotten back into songwriting, and she is releasing some really fun stuff. It's just fun to see someone so close to you get their passion back and be really good at it.
I love that.
And she's really good. Listen to her songs.
Send them to me. I'll listen.
Jody Lynn.
Mine is, look, my younger son did business undergrad and then went into venture capital for 3 years. And he was rather following in daddy's footsteps a little bit. And he came to me and said, Dad, I don't think I really want to do venture for the rest of my life. I don't want to go to, I'm not sure if I want to go to business school. I have a passion for history, and he's always had it. So he left his venture firm and he's now at King's College London doing history. And I'm so proud of him that he didn't follow the path easily traveled and went on his own journey. And I think that following your own passion in life is just so important. And I'm just really made up that he did that.
I love that. When you're having a hard time, who's someone that you call? Who's on your 911 list?
You've got one of them in front of you now. Frank, I'm really wrestling and struggling with this issue. I see this side. What do you think? And Frank has a way of reducing, first of all, taking the emotion out of big problems and then being able to break it down and think in terms of first principles. And we joke about Frank and first principles all the time. And then my wife of now 40 years, Laurie, who really is my best friend, and we've been through so much together. But in times of despair and times of darkness, Laurie's always there for me.
Love it. Frank?
Well, my wife is there to give me a little bit of balance and kind of pull me out of the black hole that I get into every once in a while when I'm deeply thinking about problems. The other thing that isn't necessarily it's in fact not a person, but it's something that I do. I actually do like to exercise when I'm thinking about a really, really tough problem and it pulls me out of my head. And so many times I end up with much clearer thinking when I come out of exercising. I'm going to answer it without, you know, the traditional answer of a person, but I'll say my Peloton.
Okay, back to Frank as a start for the final question here. This might be the hardest one too, so I'm sorry that it landed on you first, Frank. What's something that no one could find out about you online?
I have a pretty public presence, so most things about me you would be able to find. You'd be able to find that I was a high-stakes poker player for a while. Mm-hmm. You probably could find out about my comic book collection, which is quite mm-hmm. extensive. So I'm not sure what in my life isn't public. Maybe the fact that I like whiskey. How about that?
There you go. I'll take it. And I don't know that people would have been able to easily find out that your wife was a songwriter, too. I didn't know that about you. And I feel like I know quite a bit of what is about you online. That wasn't in one of your Twitter threads. Nigel, what about you? You've had time to think, so.
I have a time, yeah. So some of the things that are out there that embarrass me from time to time, you know, people talk about that I have a love for cycling and riding my bike up big hills. I'm a big Tottenham Hotspur fan. I just made an investment in Swansea City. My family's Welsh. Those things that I've talked about a little bit. But one thing I don't talk about very much was a different life that I tried to build in, you know, the late 70s and early 80s of being a singer in various new wave progressive punk bands. So, you know, I wasn't much of a singer. I certainly wasn't much of a songwriter. But getting up there with a microphone was just glorious. And I realized halfway through my undergrad that I was never going to be Simon Le Bon from Duran Duran. I was never going to be, you know, never be able to make a good living from it. So then I had to take my studies seriously. And I've been threatening with Jody, Frank's wife, playing some of her songs, that I go back to songs that I'd written and performed, 40 years ago, and get into a studio and get some proper musicians and put them down onto digital one day.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. I've had so much fun doing this series. So many of these people that, to me, have been the reason that I've stayed in this space, because one, y'all are just like fun, good people, and two, I always feel like I learn something from any of these conversations, and y'all motivate me to be better. So I really appreciate you guys taking time today. It means a lot.
Yeah, Julie, I think it's great to have done this, and I love the idea of pulling together these various people that have worked together in twosomes and have this kind of conversation. There's a certain richness that comes from it. Good work.